You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, music can be powerful, but it turns out that interesting things are going on in our brains as we listen. First, new figures released this week from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics show that wages in Wisconsin rose at one of the strongest rates of the past 10 years from September 2015 to September 2016. We'll get the details of that and other top stories now in our weekly news roundup. Robert Menser joins us now. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks.
Well, let's start with that wages story. Wisconsin wages are up. That's the good news, even though job growth is not up. That's the bad news. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, people are getting raises. It's good stuff. I mean, the unemployment rate in Wisconsin is pretty low and has been fairly low, so I'm not sure how much we need to make of the job growth, though it was a little lackadaisical. I think Wisconsin was 31st in the nation for adding new jobs. But yeah, this matter of raises is a big deal. Overall, private sector workers received 7% more in their paychecks in between this September to September time frame, and that's massive. Of course, that is an average. You or I or the listener may not have gotten that type of raise, but you know, it broke it down into some categories. So the economic category, professional and business services, which includes accountants and law firms, but also a lot of other things, had the highest rate in pay raises, 10.6%. And the leisure and hospitality industry, which is big in Wisconsin and also one of the lowest paid sectors overall, saw a wage growth of 9.4%. So that's a sign that maybe some folks more on the, you know, a little lower on the socioeconomic scale were getting raises as well, which is very important.
Do we know anything about the why behind this?
Well, I mean, to simplify something that is very complicated, part of what is going on here is just supply and demand. So because the unemployment rate is pretty low, around, you know, in the fours, that means that there isn't a huge pool of potential workers out there for employers to hire. And that means that companies, you know, look at increasing pay to keep people around.
And Rob, let's look at our next story. In national news this week, President Trump announced that he would like to increase military spending by $54 billion. And it seems like what we're hearing, this could be good news for Wisconsin. How come?
Yeah, so who knows what Congress will actually do or what will actually be signed by the president. I think there are some, you know, even some statutory problems with the proposed $54 billion hike. But the point is, this is something that that Donald Trump campaigned on, and now as president has proposed this massive increase in military spending. So it seems to be that even if we don't get a $54 billion increase, it's likely that that there will be some form of defense spending increase. So you can think that's a good thing or a bad thing on the merits as a federal policy, but it is the case that that there are a lot of Wisconsin companies that benefit from military contracts. The largest is Oshkosh Corporation, which just last year got a new $677 million contract to make or rebuild tactical trucks and do some other stuff for the military. And overall, the number that was cited in the Journal Sentinel was Wisconsin companies got $3.73 billion in federal contracts in 2016, which doesn't even include the many, many businesses that are subcontractors for that industry.
Rob, what kinds of things does Wisconsin provide for the military?
Well, so there's Marinette Marine Corporation that builds U.S. Navy ships as a subcontractor for Lockheed Martin. Certainly, Oshkosh Corporation has a lot, and you know, it's just a really big industry. This is the thing about the federal the U.S. military is a very large institution, and so there end up being tons of these businesses and sub businesses that you know work on a specific part, or you know this, you know, would you have thought that that a contract just to fix up trucks would be worth $677 million. So, you know, there are just a number of different industries that feed in.
And do we know if there is some sort of increase, maybe one as substantial as $54 billion, whether it could sort of grow new industries or around that the already present industry here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, well, the Journal Sentinel cited that more than 24,000 people are employed in Wisconsin by companies that support aerospace, just the aerospace part of this, not even, you know, sort of leaving out the, you know, ships and trucks. So, you know, if there is a run-up in military spending, there will presumably every state is going to want a piece. Every powerful legislator will be trying to direct contracts because that's what sort of politicians do. But the economic impact is real. I mean that of that much government spending, that will lead to job growth, and that, you know, that is a lot of people's livelihood in Wisconsin.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now. He's a storytelling editor for USA Today Network based in Wausau. And we're getting a check-in on the latest news stories from Wisconsin the past week or so. And Rob, this week, Governor Scott Walker proposed an increase in state spending on Wisconsin lottery advertising for the first time in a decade. What's the story there?
I find this very interesting. The Wisconsin State Journal reported on this, and Walker is looking to boost spending on advertising for the Wisconsin Lottery from $3 million per year to $10.5 million per year, which is a big jump in itself. And the story looked at the overall revenue from the lottery. Wisconsinites spent $627 million on lottery tickets last year, which is a 27% increase from where we Wisconsinites were 10 years ago. So this is a growing industry, and it also is a big pot of money that the state puts towards reductions in property taxes. Part of what is fascinating here to me, I think, is the backstory, which is Walker himself, when he was in the state legislature, was not friendly to the lottery. He supported a referendum on eliminating the state lottery, and in fact, it's, you know, this is not probably one of the biggest or most heated issues in Madison, but it is something that there can be a bit of a coalition between social conservatives and some progressives. Liberals don't like the lottery because it is essentially a regressive tax. It takes money from the poor. That is who buys lottery tickets. There is a lot of research on that. And it funnels that money to richer people in the form of property tax breaks. Social conservatives don't like it because it's gambling. And it's seen as a vice. Certainly that can be something that can hurt families, compulsive gambling. And that's sort of where Walker was coming from when he was a legislator. Now he's governor, and he's looking at that pot of lottery revenue, and it's a priority for him to cut property taxes. And so the calculus is different. I find that interesting.
But it sounds like it's not totally a sure thing. Wisconsin has advertised the lottery, spent money to do that in the past, and ticket sales have gone down, right?
Yeah, this is true. No, it's not a sure thing. And also, I mean, the lottery, like, you know, a lot of people have fun playing the lottery. I don't want to overstate the case against it, right? There's also a case that, this form of gambling is not in itself what is really bankrupting anyone's family, and people do win. I mean, you know, somebody, you know, you see the photos of people holding a giant check. So not to overstate things, but yeah, this is advertising. There are projections that this advertising would, in fact, increase revenue, which has started to flag for the program. But I guess it really depends on whether people choose to buy the ticket, doesn't it?
Rob, what kind of rules are there surrounding the advertising, what that can be in Wisconsin?
So they can promote the structure of the way that it's that the prizes are structured, but there are a lot of rules about sort of direct action calls. Go on down to the local gas station and buy your lottery ticket. There are things you can't do, but I think sort of you might analogize it to political advertising. That in a lot of cases, even in a so-called issue ad, people will get the idea of what's being promoted here, and I think that a lot of that goes on with the lottery.
Do we know how Wisconsin lottery revenue compares to other states? Are we up there?
I don't know that. You know, it seems to me like $627 million would be a lot, but I don't have that information.
And Rob, are you a lottery player?
You know, I am the sort of person, Veronica, for whom just the thought of even the thought of winning the lottery, all I can, my mind immediately goes to the like tax forms I would have to fill out, and like people, my relatives are going to be hitting me up, and it just seems like a nightmare. It's better to me. It's better. I just stay out of all that.
That's a no then.
That's a big no. Big no. What about you?
I'm the same, but I think it's mostly because I'm pessimistic and I consider myself unlucky. I never win anything, so you know, why would I bother?
Sure. Well. At any rate, we both get to the same place.
Same position. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thank you so much.
That was Robert Menser, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, and he joins us every Friday for our weekly news roundup. Coming up, we talk about what happens in your brain when you listen to music. And join us at 4 on Saturday, March 4th, for Stuck at Square One, the Remedial Education Trap. When students go to college, they expect to be in college classes, but in fact, 4 in 10 students end up in developmental math and English, relearning what they were supposed to learn in high school. The vast majority of them never get a college degree, so what's going on? In this special, we explore how students are placed in these classes and what skills people really need to be successful. That's Stuck at Square One tomorrow at 4 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, reports making the rounds throughout Washington, D.C. show that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency could face significant cuts to its budget in the coming year. We'll find out more. First, for years, scientists have reasoned music is popular, it's ancient, and it's continually ranked as one of the most supreme pleasures of life. Given all that, they wondered, is there a region of the brain that responds specifically to music? Just recently, a research team at MIT got a peek into what's being called the brain's music room. Using functional MRIs, they've identified the specific neural pathways that react almost exclusively to music. Here to talk about these findings are two members of that team from MIT. Nancy Kanwisher is a professor at MIT and an investigator at the McGovern Institute for Brain Research. Her lab uses fMRI to investigate the functional architecture of the human brain. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And also with us today, we've got Sam Norman Hagner, postdoctoral researcher at MIT, whose work focuses on understanding the human auditory cortex. Sam, welcome.
Thanks.
And so, Nancy, going into this research, what exactly were you looking for?
Well, as background, I've been looking for the last 20 years or so at the overall organization of the human brain. So we think that's a really exciting question because it's basically a way to ask, who are we? What are our brains made up of? What are the basic components of the human mind? And that's been a very exciting research program, and we've discovered a lot of specialized regions of the brain that respond very selectively to when you do very specific kinds of things, like face recognition, or reading a word, or thinking about what another person is thinking, or understanding a sentence. Each of those activates a very specific part of the brain. And so we wanted to know for a long time whether music might be another mental function that has its own special purpose brain machinery. So that was a tough question to answer until Sam came along. So maybe he can tell you what he's done.
Right. And Sam, why did music seem like such a likely candidate for dedicated brain architecture, so to speak?
Well, one of the nice things about the approach that we use to reveal this putatively music selective region is that the analysis that we used to find it basically didn't know anything about what it should find. Didn't know whether it should find something that was selected for music or speech or, you know, whatever else. And so as a result, when we ran this analysis and it basically revealed this neural population that responded selectively to music, we found that sort of particularly striking, because basically the analysis didn't know anything about what it should find a priori.
So you said this is a kind of a neutral way. This is computational. How did this work? How did you get to this answer, Nancy?
The simple way of thinking of it is we start with a large amount of data. So we have 10,000 individual three-dimensional pixels or voxels across 10 subjects' brains in their broader auditory cortex, and we know the magnitude of the response of each of those pixels to each of 165 different sounds. So that's 18 million numbers. And then what we do is we ask the math to simplify this and give us a simple description of the data, and it basically finds six simple components that can account for most of the data. And that didn't have to be. That was a cool result in itself, that we could understand and characterize the response of the brain to this wide array of different kinds of sounds with six simple patterns. And it just emerged when we looked at those six patterns that one of them reflected selectivity for music. And that's just remarkable, because the space of possible things we could find is just enormous. And the fact that one of them very neatly mapped on, just when we looked at it, you could just see, oh, that's music selectivity, a high response to all of these wildly different kinds of music sounds, and a low response to everything else. So it just popped right out of the raw data.
And I want to give a listen to some of the things that your subjects were listening to, because you have a whole array of, I guess, auditory cues, different sounds, and music. Let's listen to the sounds first.
It's supposed to either rain or snow.
Hannah is good at compromising.
Okay, so you've got the stuff of everyday life there. You've got toilets flushing. You've got people talking. You've got people brushing your teeth. The brains of your subjects heard all that. And they also heard some music. They heard stuff like this. So they heard all that, tons of different styles of music there, all those different sounds mixed in. How did the brain tell them apart?
Well, so, I mean, like,
one of the interesting aspects of the finding is that this music selective population that we discovered responded to lots of different types of music. And one of the interesting facts about music in general is that music is a remarkably heterogeneous category. There are lots of different types of things that people typically call music. And it's very different from the types of categories that we know exist for other types of things. So, for example, speech is a much more homogenous category. You know, the different types of speech sounds that people encounter are in some sense much more similar than the different types of music that we encounter. And so the fact that you find a brain region that responds in some sense strongly to all of these different types of music is sort of one of the interesting results of the experiment.
And I just to back up a moment, music is fascinating because every human culture that's been studied has it, and no animal that's been studied has anything approaching human music. And so it's both uniquely and universally human, and yet at the same time, nobody even knows why we have it. So evolutionary theorists have been fighting for a long time trying to understand why we have music, and nobody has a really clear story about why we have it. And so one story was that music just kind of piggybacks on other brain mechanisms, for example, mechanisms for understanding speech or processing language or God knows what else, right? And what our result shows is understanding music or perceiving music isn't just a byproduct of other mechanisms. It has its own special purpose mechanism. So it's its own thing. It's not a byproduct. And I think that's a fascinating result of this research.
We're talking right now with Nancy Kanwisher and Sam Norman Hagner, part of the team that use functional MRIs to locate specific neural pathways in the brain that respond exclusively to music. And as you were saying, Nancy, from an evolutionary perspective, it doesn't seem like music would be as important to survival as, say, speech. So what do we know about why music may have this privileged role in the brain, and how is that going to change the way that we think about music?
Well, the why questions are very hard. I think the answer could easily have been otherwise, and it's an empirical result that, wow, apparently we do have this special purpose machinery. The question of why different mental functions get specialized machinery in the brain is a really big, important one, but we just don't know the answer. And I want to mention that, like, not everything that has special machinery in the brain is the product of evolution and natural selection. So, for example, there's a part of the brain that responds very selectively and strongly to visually presented words. And that can't be a result of natural selection, because people haven't been reading long enough for evolution to have crafted it. So we shouldn't assume that just because there are special neural mechanisms for music that they've evolved. It may be that they result from extensive experience with music. And this is something we can't tell yet from our current experiments. But Sam has lots of ideas of what to do next to find out.
Right, and I'd love to hear that, Sam. Where would you like to see this research go from here?
So there are a lot of sort of open questions about what this specific music population does. So, for example, you asked the question of, you know, how does your brain differentiate between all the different types of music that you typically listen to? And that's basically a question that we don't really know the answer to. We know that there's, you know, this population that responds strongly to lots of different types of music, but we don't know, for example, whether there are subpopulations within this area that, say, respond to musical rhythms or to musical pitches or to musical harmonies. Basically, we don't know how all of the different aspects of musical structure that you're sensitive to and care about are mapped in this population and other populations of the brain.
Does this tell you as a researcher, though, just for the layperson, that, yeah, there's a reason why we respond so powerfully to music?
That's a very hard question, I think, to answer. I mean, it suggests that music is a sufficiently sort of important category to warrant, you know, a relatively large piece of tissue to process it. But exactly how that maps onto, you know, our appreciation of music and the emotional impact that music has on us is a sort of a harder question to answer, I think.
All right, we'll leave it there. Nancy and Sam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Nancy Kanwisher and Sam Norman Hagner. They're part of the MIT team that studies how the brain responds to music. Coming up, we'll talk about the possible impact of proposed budget cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we get the latest from Washington with Ken Rudin's Political Junkie tonight at 7 o'clock. First, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency could be facing sweeping and dramatic cuts to its budget in the next year. That's according to reports coming from Washington, D.C. These proposed cuts could have widespread ramifications across the country, including here in Wisconsin. Among the proposed cuts are significant reductions for funds to protect the Great Lakes and other projects nationwide. Andy Olson joins us now. He's the senior policy advocate for the Environmental Law and Policy Center. He's based in Madison. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. Good afternoon.
Well, can you describe the scope of the proposed cuts?
Sure. These are cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, which the president has said is to allow us to increase spending for the Department of Defense. And there's a wide range of cuts over multiple programs, which total to $1.1 billion. And this is an leaked list of cuts. We don't know if these will be the final cuts. We'll find out in a couple of weeks.
And these cuts are not finalized. They'll have to be approved by Congress. But specifically, what would these cuts do?
Well, they occur to a lot of different programs, but there are a number that will hit home here in Wisconsin and for a lot of other states. One that a lot of people care about in Wisconsin is for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And that's a program that's got a $300 million annual budget to help our Great Lakes, which are really, you know, a national treasure and the largest freshwater bodies in the world. And this program does a lot of things to help clean up toxics. It helps to combat invasive species, protect shorelines and wetlands. And, you know, we've seen problems like in Lake Erie with very large algae blooms due to pollution in that lake, and that's a concern there. And this program helps with this, and it helps work with local partners on the ground as well. Well, this proposed budget cut would be 97%. It would basically nearly eliminate the program, cut the funding from $300 million to $10 million. And, you know, it would basically sound a retreat in terms of protecting the Great Lakes. Of course, that's a great concern for Wisconsin because, you know, we're bordered by two Great Lakes, Superior and Michigan.
And what about funding for the restoration of Brownfield, the former industrial sites?
Yes, this is something that helps a lot of urban areas and in areas where there have been abandoned sites for industrial sites, helps to recover and reclaim them. And what we often see happen is that that results in new job creation. So instead of having an abandoned, shuttered facility, you know, where businesses might want to go invest in a green field somewhere, you know, that has not been previously developed, this helps to recycle that industrial property and helps get it going to actually create jobs. And so, you know, that's an example of another program where, you know, it helps the economy and it helps the environment and it helps us to deal with perhaps contaminated properties as well. Another one that really jumped out at me when I looked at this list is one for lead renovation, repair, and painting. And, you know, that doesn't sound like a real big deal, but after what we saw in Flint, Michigan with the heartbreaking, lead contamination in the water supply, well, this is another example of lead poisoning, which affects children. And this program addresses lead-based paint in homes, in child care facilities, and preschools. And they will cut this by about 30%. And, you know, again, if we can't protect our children from lead poisoning, you know, where are the priorities that we have? Again, I would say this is a form of national defense, protecting future generations toward the future for this country.
Do you know where these cuts, these proposed cuts, I should say, would leave research, environmental research, and maybe in particular climate change research?
Right. You know, as we know, we're hearing a lot of talk about hostility to dealing with climate change, and there's kind of this attitude that we can be, you know, penny wise and pound foolish with it. We've seen from industry, we've seen from government, we've seen from our private sector, a lot of, you know, can-do approach to the problems of climate change. And there's a lot of companies that have stepped forward, and they're taking the technologies that have been developed with public investment, and they're bringing them to the marketplace. I mean, we just saw today that three different companies, for example, are bringing advanced battery storage forward. Well, you know, a lot of the problems that we face in terms of environmental problems, you know, we can overcome. And we've seen a lot of companies that have stepped up and have provided ways to deal with the problems once, you know, we make a public decision that we are going to confront and overcome these problems. And this is a part of a public-private partnership where funds are shared to do research, to find ways to overcome these problems and to effectively deal with them. And what we find time and time again is that the alarmists say when we have new regulatory protections against pollution that, oh, we can't do that, it'll hurt the economy. But instead what happens is that spurs a new round of innovation and development from the private sector to find ways to overcome these problems.
We're talking with Andy Olson right now. He's the senior policy advocate for the Environmental Law and Policy Center based in Madison, and talking about proposed cuts to the EPA, which would reduce the EPA by one-fifth. And Andy, let's back up a little bit and look at the founding of the EPA. What was its mission when it was founded?
Well, the funding, the EPA was started actually under Richard Nixon, and he signed a legislation that created the Environmental Protection Agency. So it's really kind of shocking that we have a Republican president, Donald Trump, now cutting back on that initiative, and that was in response to a lot of the kind of widespread environmental problems we saw back in the '60s and early '70s, and the American people, led by public leaders like Wisconsin's own Gaylord Nelson, stepped forward and said, we've got to deal with the damage being done to our waters and to our air. And what we've seen since that time is through the EPA, through state efforts, which Wisconsin used to be a leader in, a lot of, can-do approaches that say, we're going to deal with these problems, we're going to overcome them. Now, today, we don't see quite the same level of visibility of air quality problems, for example, that we might have seen back then. But if we backslide, if we sound the retreat from dealing with these problems, then we will see, a return to those problems in short order. We're seeing it now in China. They've got rampant industrialization, and they do not have, this level of environmental protection. A lot of companies from the U.S. have moved their operations there. And, they're dealing with some very severe public health problems as a result. And again, I just kind of come back and shake my head because, we hear that this is being done in order to increase the national defense and provide funding for the Department of Defense. Well, providing for the public health, safety, and welfare of the American people is a part of providing for the national defense. Protecting the American people from pollution is a form of national defense. And, we should not admit defeat before these problems. We should not, give up. We should keep trying and maintain these efforts and working together as a nation. The EPA was created with a bipartisan spirit. We should return to that and work together to fight pollution.
President Trump has very clearly said that he's invested in clean water and clean air. Do you see the EPA being able to meet clean air and water goals with these cuts, or do you see these goals being taken up by another agency or maybe states themselves?
No, I don't see any basis for that statement. I mean, he's got $1 billion in cuts here, including to a program for safe and sustainable water resources, which is to help improve technology for drinking water supplies. We don't see anything to deal with the widespread problem of lead pollution in drinking water supplies. It's not just Flint, it's all over the country. And, we know how to fix that. He's cutting back on marine pollution. Just across the board, he's reducing the wherewithal for our nation to deal with this problem. And so, maybe he's got a magic wand or something, or he just thinks that if we all think the right way, it'll change. But we know it takes resources to confront these problems. And, we also have the problem that he has appointed to head the EPA, the new administrator, Scott Pruitt, formerly the Attorney General of Oklahoma. Well, a Wisconsin group called the Center for Media and Democracy won the, through an open records request in Oklahoma, finally, won the emails from that office and found that he worked very closely with polluting industries to undermine and to gut environmental protections that protect the public health, safety, and welfare. And so this is the fellow now who's going to be running the EPA. And in his first comment to the staff at the EPA, he stressed that their job is to serve the industries they regulate, not to serve the public, but to serve the industries and to help them with easier regulations. And there's no indication from the president that, for example, for the water quality problems in Flint, there's no initiative from him to deal with that. There's no initiative anywhere that I've seen from him to deal with pollution problems, with modern pollution problems that continue to persist. For example, he's cutting programs that deal with endocrine pollution, which is like basically hormonal pollution or pollution that affects the endocrine system of the human body. Well, that's a problem across the country.
We're talking to Andy Olson right now. He's the senior policy advocate for the Environmental Law and Policy Center. And we're talking about the proposed financial cuts that could come to the Environmental Protection Agency. And we'd like to hear from you on this. Are you concerned about the proposed cuts? What projects do you think could be threatened under these cuts? Or do you think that the EPA has too many regulations, stifles business, and needs to be streamlined? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the proposed funding and staffing cuts that could come to the Environmental Protection Agency. The White House is looking to reduce funding for the EPA and the size of the agency by one-fifth. Andy Olson is with us. He's the Senior Policy Advocate for the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and we'd like to hear from you. What do you think of the proposed cuts, and what do you think the future of the EPA should be? Is this a good idea to balance increased military spending, and is the EPA too bogged down in regulations? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go now to our first caller. We have Dan with us in Appleton. Dan, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
This is for your guest. Just a question. I mean, specifically going back to the Flint water issue, my understanding is that there are at least a couple people who have been identified as not having done their job and basically allowing this to happen. I guess my question to the guest is, this is a very local issue, and I do not care for our president, his policies, et cetera, but it being a local issue, how does he come into play here since we already have identified the problem, hopefully identified a solution, and identified those who are responsible? Why not keep it local?
Dan, thanks a lot for that question, and what do you say to that, Andy?
Well, sure. I mean, when you're talking about a water distribution system, it's certainly local. It comes to your house from the water supply. And it was local in the case of Flint, and there were some individual mistakes that were made or some malfeasance that was done. And we might yet see justice on that. But we also know at the same time that there are lead pipes used throughout the country for water drinking supplies. We've heard reports recently in Wisconsin of lead pipes and water fountains and lead in the drinking water supply in schools. So we have not dealt with the problem just because of the individual Flint issue. We've got a lurking problem throughout the country that we've got to deal with, because this could happen again. It could happen in any number of ways. And we still have lead pipes carrying and delivering water. And so, And again, we've got lead programs that reduce exposure to children from lead poisoning, which affects their, intellectual development, that are being cut by this budget that we're seeing, this draft budget. So it's an example of where the American people came together and reacted with horror to what was done, because so many of us, regardless of what our party is, do care about protecting our environment, our natural heritage, and future generations. And that's a widely shared value in America. And so we should not retreat from it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dan. And we're going to go next to Simmer in Milwaukee. Hi, Simmer.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. What did you want to add?
I kind of wanted to add, going back to the state of Wisconsin, hunting and fishing are a tradition. And I think Great Lakes, any lakes, any streams, they provide not only food, but they also provide, entertainment. And a lot of kids learn these things from their grandfathers, their fathers. And it just kind of feels like deception where we want to protect the country, but we also want to take away all of these resources by cutting the EPA.
Simmer, thank you for that. What do you think about some of these state environmental culture like we have here in Wisconsin as it relates to the EPA, Andy?
Sure. Well, he makes a great point, and it occurs at different levels. I mean, he's talking about some of our traditions and our practices, enjoying the outdoors, enjoying fishing and hunting. It's very often a family activity passed on from generation to generation. And when we have environmental degradation and we do not take care of our natural heritage, then we begin to lose that cultural tradition. And also, there's an economic aspect, because if we're not taking care of the environment that helps to support those those jobs, and there's entire industries around those. You know, it might be hunting and fishing, it might be in paddling, it might be in hiking or camping. All these sort of activities that are good for family health, good for us to get out and experience. The more we degrade our environment, the more we lose those. And we've seen in the past month now, which is very disheartening, in the American West, a big pushback from those who like to hunt and fish against plans to develop energy resources on our public lands out west. And there's been a very big pushback from the grassroots, from people who enjoy those traditions. And so that, I think, is something that the president has lost track of. I doubt he really enjoys those habits, those practices himself.
We're talking with Andy Olson right now, senior policy advocate for the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Madison, talking about the White House plan to reduce the EPA by one-fifth. And Andy, one criticism of the EPA over the years, as it's become more politicized, is that the EPA is too burdened with regulations that can stifle the growth of business. What do you think about that?
Well, that's that's actually just not the case. And, you know, we can point to studies if people want to talk studies that can bore a lot of people. But basically what the studies find is that it's a wash. You know, the regulations might hurt some industries that are the sources of the pollution, but then they often spark growth in other industries. So, example, catalytic converters in vehicles reduce pollution from personal vehicles. And, you know, we also see, and I experience in my own work in clean energy, a lot of companies that respond to public challenges coming forth with new technologies. And there's just so much creativity and innovation out there, and people are investing in new companies to do this. We see a lot of companies that have accepted, you know, the challenge to cut their carbon footprint or their increase their sustainability. Big companies have stepped forward to do that. So we got some companies that are polluters and are bad actors, and they fund politicians that are trying to gut our environmental protections. But then we have others that step forward with a can-do attitude. And, you know, there's a lot of young people that are, they come and intern for me. They're very eager to work on finding solutions to environmental problems. They dedicate themselves to it. They look forward to careers solving those problems, and it's a part of the culture for many of them. So it's really a false choice to say that the only way that we can grow our economy is by polluting our country. There used to be a phrase when I was a kid, America the Beautiful, and that's what I think motivated a lot of us to keep this country beautiful and to pass it off to the next generation in better shape than we got it. I hope we can, as a country, return to that value and to do that for the future generation.
Let's take one more call here. We've got Jeff on the line in Platteville. Jeff, hi.
Hi there. I think you just touched on it a little bit, but I wanted to point out that so many of these regressive policies are based on a persistent myth, I call it, that corporations are struggling, that the economy is struggling. And it's not, it's only struggling for the common man, for the corporations and for the economic elite. Things are going gangbusters. So I think it's really, you know, a huge falsehood that we have to cut corporations all these little breaks and, you know, let them go ahead and pollute because they're hurting so bad. We have to really cut them every kind of slack. And it's just a lot of bull. I mean, they don't need the breaks.
Jeff, thank you for that call. And Andy, what do you agree with Jeff about that? That corporations are doing okay, and that it doesn't need bolstering on the back of the EPA, for instance.
Yes, broadly speaking, yeah, I don't think that there's evidence that companies are struggling because they're not able to pollute. And really what we're seeing happen here is that the environmental protection is being used as a scapegoat for the economic anxieties, for job problems, for falling wages that so many people in the middle class are facing. And it's really not the case. I mean, there are a lot of other reasons why wages are being driven down, and it's really being done by a lot of the same economic forces that are behind trying to repeal environmental protections. So, you know, we can have good jobs and good wages, and we can also have a livable, clean environment at the same time. That's a false choice to say that we've got to, you know, have pollution if we want to have jobs. You know, it's automation that's killing jobs, offshoring employment. things of that nature that are really hurting and driving wages down. So there, if we want to work on improving jobs and wages, there are a lot of other better solutions. For example, right now the solar industry employs more people than the coal industry, just for one example of many.
And we leave it there. Jeff, thank you for that call. And Andy, thanks to you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
You too. That was Andy Olson, Senior Policy Advocate for the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Madison. He was with us to talk about the White House plan to reduce the Environmental Protection Agency by one-fifth. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.